Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hi, Guy.
Hi, Gary.
We're together.
We are together. This is weird, isn't it? I can touch you.
I know, we're not on Zoom, we're in real life.
Yeah.
And I think this is quite nice. And this was called by Paul.
That's what's so nice. He insisted on being in the room.
Yeah.
Where it happens.
We made it work. So my dog's not going to be barking. The Amazon guys are going to be ringing on the doorbell.
Well, we'll see about that. but this is a fabulous one today because it's someone we both know. I mean, yeah. I've known Paul for many years back when I used to do such things. He's someone I've propped up many a bar with and a more fabulous sort of, a companion.
Well, I think the bass. Well, you're bass players as well, aren't you?
We are bass players.
So bass players always tend to sort of coalesce.
We do, although it's not something that we ever talk about. We've got so many, because Paul has this great love of all the stuff that we love, of that whole post-war thing of like Round the Horn and Tony Hancock and all that. A lot of which I think is quite evident in his new album, which we're hopefully going to be talking about.
Well, I'm in kind of different attitude towards him, really, because I have to say he changed my life. And we'll talk about that. And I'm sure I'll bore you with it again and tell you when I first saw him play live on stage.
Yeah, I can't imagine where that was. but I'm sure we'll find out. No, listen, he changed my life. Because you've got to remember, I just got my first bass guitar. And this was at a time when, people became bass players because the band didn't have one. And it was the last thing left. And then suddenly these guys show up. And, The Clash were, without a doubt, the coolest looking band you've ever seen in your life. 100%. And the coolest looking bloke in the coolest looking band is the bass player.
I know.
So he changed your life, mate.
Well, he did. And I don't think, the emphasis on bass players and being how good looking they were, John Taylor and Martin Kemp have all got thank for it. I know that Martin holds Paul as one of his great heroes too. So I'm a little bit nervous.
Also, this is the man, the subject of, without a doubt, the greatest rock and roll photograph of all time.
We'll get on to that.
Welcome to the Rock on Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
That's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
Well, I get the feeling that us three should go for a pint. That's what I think.
I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock on Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking!
Paul, welcome.
Hello.
Welcome.
Hello. Nice to see you both.
This is our first face-to-face one we've done for so long. It's quite frightening.
Yeah,
is it? I'm so sorry.
Well, especially if we haven't seen you for ages.
No, not for a long time.
We've known you for a long time. And it's nice, and it's always nice and rare to have someone on. It was on my bedroom wall when
really?
I was
a kid. What himself?
Yeah. What?
Physically.
Himself.
Well, he was an art student. I think it was an installation thing he was working on.
But listen, thanks for doing this. I mean, obviously, like Guy said, we'll get on to this, but you did partially change my life.
Well, The Clash certainly changed my life too.
Yeah.
In lots of ways. In fact, really, I should really say I sort of blame Mick Jones, really. But in fact, Mick Jones and Bernie Rhodes, because Mick had a band together, London SS.
Yeah.
And on meeting Mick for the first time, I also met Bernie Rhodes. And after I left, Bernie Rhodes apparently said to Mick, get rid of your band and start a band with that bloke that just left. It's like Bernie's idea of mixing musicians with non-musicians in the same way that he got John Lydon to be the singer of the Pistols.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because you uniquely, amongst everyone, you said you're the one guy who actually went to art college to learn to paint.
I wanted to be
rather than start a band.
That's it. Because growing up, every artist seemed to be called Paolo or Paul or Pablo. And recently, I found out that Jackson Pollock's first name was Paul. So I thought, well, this is obviously my job. But then I got to art college, I got a scholarship, and I was having a problem with the college because they weren't, I really wanted to do life drawing because I wanted to learn how to look, which is what drawing should be about. And they say, oh, you don't need to do that, just draw these squares and it's American abstract art, that's what we're into. So after a year, I sort of ran into Mick Jones at this rehearsal place. And basically, after Bernie's comment about getting the band together, I hooked up with Mick and took my grant and vanished from art college.
Hang on, we need to set the scene. You didn't have a bass at this. Did you have a bass?
No, I didn't have a bass. Yeah. So I'd never played an instrument in my life. In fact, I got kicked out of music lessons at school. So it's probably a good sign for the future, really.
He had a lot, in a way, he had a lot in common with my brother, who didn't play bass. We only put him in the band because he was the best-looking bloke we knew, which is probably the same with Paul. And then I taught him the bass overnight as much as I could.
I learned right in the beginning. I learned a lot from, Mick sort of showed me everything, to be honest. And what made it easier, I actually painted the notes on the neck of the bass. So if Mick shouted in the middle of the song, A, go to A, B, go to B. Oh, Tave Mick. Yeah, big ding.
Did you keep that bass or did you smash it up at one point?
No, I think I lent it to somebody else. I just sort of passed it on.
But you did bring a lot, but it's very well, you didn't play an instrument, but you brought a lot of music with you, didn't you?
Well, my background was sort of essentially, I grew up in Brixton and Labbot Grove.
Yeah.
So it was quite a strong, vibrant.
And that's
community.
The ultimate box tick London upbringing, yeah, isn't it? Really,
well,
right
in
there.
A way, they invented that because it wasn't the box tick before they came along. No, and then suddenly it was Brixton and Labyrinth Road.
It really helps a lot because of that background, insofar as trying to practice bass, playing along with The Who, I could hardly hear what the bass, because it's so guitar and drums orientated, really, in sound wise, sonically. Whereas reggae was in that I just put the record on and play along to it and work out the lines that way.
Yeah, and also it's a much deeper, you know, John Entwistle is always up the neck, isn't he?
It's like a different thing.
There's no bass in it. There's no bass in it, basically.
Yeah, it's like a groove. It's almost like each bass line in Jamaican music, to me anyway. It's a bit like how you move your feet. It's like how you dance to it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know.
So was that the music you were buying before punk?
I wouldn't say buying because I didn't really have the money, but I'd be hanging out at friends and people would gather some income to, or somebody just had a single, or you go. I used to go to Strep Meccano in South London, and that was like when you were too old for Saturday morning pictures and too old to go to a club. It was sort of an in between sort of place, and it was basically packed with skinheads, a few girls up against the wall, and just everyone having a punch up, and they sort of played sort of Elizabethan reggae, you know, those.
David Ansel
sort of,
Collins.
Yeah, all that stuff. So, but they closed it down after a month or two because it just got too out of control.
Let's just mention London SS again, because that's a sort of band that have gone into myth and legend because you can't even find one single song on the internet of theirs. Was that directly influenced at that time? Was there a sort of influence from the New York Dolls?
Definitely, because when I walked in, it's like I couldn't really recognize anybody because their hair was quite long and maybe Brian James is probably one that had a bit more of a face that I could speak to.
Right.
It was very New York Dolls.
Of course, because they went on to do The Damned. Yeah.
Yeah, but there was that one Vivian T-shirt, wasn't it? Which was like the statement of intent. This is before.
That was
one
Bernie
day you're going to wait. Okay.
That was Bernie Rhodes' T-shirt because he used to work with Malcolm and Vivian.
There you go. Right.
And then they parted company.
I mean, as it came out under their label.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was one day you're going to wake up and know which side of the bed you're on.
Yeah. And eventually Bernie left them and decided to get in a band himself because they had the Pistols in its early birth.
Wasn't it Call Me Bernard, I'm Not a Cab Driver? Wasn't that? He was very heavy.
I'm Not a Bloody Cabbie.
Yeah.
That's it.
But I suppose as well, The Ramones as well was that.
The Ramones is a really, really big influence. And I went to see them at Dingwalls. And actually, I met them before they did their rehearsal sound check. And I was with Keith Levine, who sadly passed on. Yeah. There's a picture of us with the Ramones outside looking very happy that we were with the Ramones. Then watched the concert, which is like, it was like, after every song, it was just like one, two, three, four, straight into the next song. Straight into the next song. Mm. It was quite mind blowing.
Did you have a fight with JJ Burnell at that gig?
I did. yes.
We've had one side of this.
Well, okay. Well, I did meet him years later, but this is a very strange coincidence. Yeah, and I was walking at that time, I wasn't on the dole or anything. So I was sort of, I don't know. I think when you're sort of malnourished, you tend to spit a lot. And anyway, I walked past him and he put his foot out to try and trip me over. And I sort of kicked his foot away as I walked past. And then he came up to me at the bar and started massaging his throat, because that's what they used to do on stage when they were going to, I think Hugh Coleman might have done that.
To work up a gop?
Or something like that, yeah, basically.
Oh, those days.
Oh, yeah.
So while he was
doing... You tell that to kids now.
I know.
So while he was doing that, I just gave him a right hook and he went flying across the tables. And Malcolm and Bernie Rhodes were sitting there and started applauding. Next minute, I was grabbed, thrown outside by the bouncers. And strangely enough... no reason I understand why, but John Lydon was thrown out as well. So we were both standing next to each other going, what just happened? I said, oh, I just had an issue with somebody inside. And then suddenly Burnell, he was chucked out as well. But then they had these guys called the Finchley mob that used to follow them around.
Oh, right, yeah,
so
yeah.
They came out as well. So it was like, okay, so John's suddenly in the middle of something that's nothing to do with him. And then... and I've got the Finchley mob and Jack Burnell, and we're sizing up to each other. I was unaware that he was a black belt, but that didn't bother me. and then suddenly the Ramones came out and said, what's going on? And that dissipated everything.
Oh,
and then
God.
When DD left, he gave me a miniature samurai letter opener. So I don't know if that was protection or...
Is he a black belt in gobbing?
But many years later, I was on a motorcycle on a Triumph going up towards Primrose Hill, and there was a fellow on another motorcycle. He was sort of going more or less the same route, and I looked over and said, oh, nice bike, and he sort of thumbs up, and we kept going. And by the time we got to the traffic lights near Primrose Hill, he was alongside me. He went, is that you, Paul? I said, oh, hi, Jack. Yeah. And we sort of shook hands and went our merry way.
Amazing. I mean, that is straight out of a movie, isn't it? Well, both on their Harley Davidsons. Or
Triumphs,
even better, yeah, even better. Were the Pistols actually formed by then?
Yeah, oh, definitely.
Because how had you all found each other in the very... I mean, how you're talking about all these people. You got Keith Devine, you got Mick. What were you coalescing around to begin?
Well, the thing is, I was at art college, and a friend of mine, he went to art college because he wanted to be in a band. He said he ran into two guys in the street and they asked him if he was a drummer. Apparently he had drumsticks sticking out his back pocket or something. He said, yeah. And they said, well, come to our rehearsal, we'll try you out. And these two people were Mick Jones and Tony James. And my friend said, he's going. He said, will you come along? I said, yeah, I'll come along as support, just in case they're just as muscle or security or whatever. And we got there and that's where I met everybody. I met Bernie and I did a trial run on a bit of... They said, oh, you're a singer? I said, no, I'm a painter. And they sort of said, oh, do you know this song? I said, no. It's like they had sort of, like there was some song called I'm a Young Barracuda and Don't You Mess With Me. So anyway, it was a disaster. But I think they sort of liked the way I looked. And then I went up to Bernie. I said, so are you the manager of this band or something? He said, why, what's it to you? And I thought, oh, not much. And then left, and my friend didn't get the job. And then somehow I met up with Mick in the street, and it continued. He knew Keith Levine, and it was like about trying out with Mick, learning to play bass, really. He did try guitar with me at first, but it was taking too long.
Because London was just pub rock at that point, wasn't it? With all these bands being sort of, you know, boogie woogie.
Which is where Joe was, right?
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, Mick knew Glenn Matlock and it sort of, I don't know, we used to just sort of hang out. I suppose, like you're saying, sort of like if there's like Dr. Feelgood on, you'd go there and you'd see those faces, or Alex Harvey was another amazing artist.
I remember at the time Eddie and the Hot Rods were doing a little bit of stuff as well. There was this high energy music that was.
Yeah, but it's like Kilburn and the High Roads, Ian Dury, and Dr. Feelgood and Alex Harvey were the main ones. And so I used to run into these characters at these shows. So I suppose it was creating a bit of a scene. And I suppose Mick would pop down to Kings Road, pop into Vivian, the Malcolm shop, probably run into Steve. And I started hanging out with Steve Jones because he had a flat in Soho. Yeah, I don't know. It sort of ended up being at the same parties. And
you know. But what were the clothes you were wearing? Because obviously they were starting to be dressed up by
Well, they were being dressed by Vivian. And
which
I think,
was still, as is a point, which was a designer clothes shop at that point. That stuff was really expensive.
Yeah. And the thing is, it was no good for us to wear that stuff. Otherwise, we'd look like the Pistols. But because of my background growing up on Labbot Grove, the market stalls there was sort of secondhand clothes available. In fact, I remember my parents were separated. My mum gave my dad $5 to buy me a school uniform. The badge cost $4, and the jacket cost a shilling. So basically, it was oversized, but I sort of pretended it was a drape and wore a black shirt with my black and yellow striped school tie. So it was about making do with what was there. So
I remember when I was 11 and my mum bought me a pair of school trousers to go to my new senior school. And they were about four sizes too big for me because she wanted me to grow into them. So I went into school so embarrassed, and I told everyone they were parallels.
Oh, well, there you go.
Bowie pegs.
That's it. You convince yourself with your imagination that that's what it is, and in some ways that's what it becomes.
But you're right, but that whole secondhand, I used to work at a secondhand shop up the top of Rip at Portobello Road, and it was all the, and a lot of it was new stuff. All the 50s stuff that you could get here was fantastic.
And dirt cheap.
And dirt cheap, yeah.
But it's like getting secondhand suits with straight leg trousers. They were everywhere because nobody wanted them. Yeah. Everybody was wearing flares in those days.
Yeah.
I did see a picture of you around the time. It might have been at that Ramones gig, and but it was obviously a skinhead rather than a hippie thing. You were wearing tie-dye at that time.
Oh, no. Yeah. What that was, I know that was like a blue shirt with a suit or something.
Yeah.
So what happened? Did the Pistols form and then you started going and then you thought, well, we need a singer.
It was sort of happening. Well, the Pistols was probably about a year or 6 months before us, and we sort of followed along.
In
the wake of getting their own thing together.
I suppose getting Joe was the big step, wasn't it?
Yeah, we saw Joe perform and thought he was brilliant, but his band, it was a bit hippie-ish and, anyway, we ran into him in the street in Portobello. Mick said, oh, you're really great, but your band's rubbish. And in the end, we said to Bernie Rhodes, here, we want to get Joe as the singer. So Joe approached Bernie and said, I'm forming this band to challenge the Pistols. By this point, Joe had already done two shows with the Pistols at the Nashville Rooms.
Oh.
So he was aware that there was a new idea coming through music.
Because Keys to Your Heart isn't that far away from what ends up as Joe in the Clash, is it?
Yeah, in some ways, there's elements there. And in the end, Bernie said, right, I'll give you 48 hours to decide and then I'll give you a call to see if you're in or not. And then after 24 hours, Bernie said, listen, I can't wait for the other 24 hours. Are you in? And Joe said, yes.
Because isn't there, I seem to remember a story about it was some of you we're at the Dole office at the same time as Joe, and there's this thing of being in the queue and just sort of eyeing each other.
Yeah, we're just looking at Joe going, he's there. Oh, that's Joe from the, because we'd just seen him the night before. And he was looking at us thinking, and he did say that he thought that he'd hit Mick first because he was just lightest and leg it for me because he thought
Mick
I looked
first,
a bit too tasty.
You did look
a bit
tasty, yeah.
That other guy's a bit big.
Did they start writing straight away, Mick?
Straight away. Well, Joe had some song, obviously, from the 101ers, and Mick had a few songs. And basically, Joe didn't want to play any of his songs. So in a way, it all started essentially from Mick's songs. Yeah. I mean, Mick had a song called I'm So Bored With You. And Joe misheard that and thought, wow, that's a good idea. But he thought it said, I'm so bored with the USA.
Fantastic.
And anyway, and with Bernie's encouragement, it sort of developed. And I mean, I was still learning how to play bass, really.
So do you remember the first gig?
Yes, I do. It was in Sheffield and Mucky Duck. And we had Keith Levine with us as well at that time. And
it was a five-piece, yeah.
Yeah, that was the first time I'd been on stage, so it was a bit terrifying. But I, I sort of distracted myself in the back of the van, which had we were sitting in the back of a van. The back door was open, and I had Keith Levine's plimsoll on a piece of string and let it out so we watch it bumping up and down. Unfortunately, it was a big queue of traffic because they couldn't get past this bit of string with his plimsoll bouncing. So that distracted me, and then suddenly the time came on stage, and in some ways it was like being in rehearsals. It felt, because I wasn't on my own. I was with Mick and Joe, and then there was one. We had one song called Listen, where it sort of goes da 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 da, and then the song starts. So, but when I played it, I went da 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 da. Running out of notes, and Joe was laughing, and anyway.
And was the Bromley contingent there? They hadn't come up?
No, not up in Sheffield. There was a handful of people there that watching the show.
Because I saw your second gig. I know you did a gig in between. You did a sort of private gig. But I went to... Did I tell you this? Have I ever told you that I went to the Screen and the Green to see The Clash, The Sex Pistols and The Buzzcocks? I was 16. Changed my life, but I've sadly erased Keith Levine from my memory because I didn't remember it was a five piece. What I do remember is when you came on, and you came on after the Buzzcocks, is you had boiler suits on with paint splattered like Jackson Pollock all over.
That's it, yep.
And your legs were so wide apart, akimbo, and it just looked, and the guitars were so low, and it was the most exciting thing I'd seen since then.
Well, you have to stand like that with a bass. It's bloody heavy.
Are you taking notes?
I'm taking notes. I've been taking notes for years, mate.
And it was extraordinary for me. I got invited along by Steve. I'm going to tell this story quickly.
Go on, you can tell it to him.
What happened is that the assistant manager of the Screen and the Green was a guy who used to work at our school, Steve Woolley. He'd go to our school. And he said, you've got to come along to this. And he became Steve Woolley. He did Palace Pictures. And of course, the Buzzcocks came on, which were great, you know, but they were still about art school, you know. But it was you, when you walked on, that look, that energy. It had a lot of glam rock feel to it in many ways. But it was also the sort of, you were pretending you didn't care, but you really fucking cared.
Well, we cared about staying in tune, that's for sure.
I know, because I've heard I listened to the tape the other day. There's lots of tuning up at the beginning, which I didn't remember.
Yeah, well, I was lucky because I had Mick to help me tune up. Mick would come over and tune the bass for me. So.
But what was odd about that gig? If people look back and imagine punk, of everyone pogoing around and going crazy. They weren't. People were just sitting.
People were sitting down like they was at the cinema.
Massaging their matinee.
But it was a strange kind of audience to play in front of.
Yeah. I think the Buzzcocks, they were amazing. And I remember we did some quite early shows with them, probably around about the time that you're talking of. And they came on as the support band and they had like Mondrian shirts.
Oh, right.
That's
right.
Brilliant. That's we came on with the Jackson Pollock shirt. So it's like, oh, this is neat.
But it's true, but it's always art, isn't it? That's the funny that runs through it. It's that whole art school. And it got, you know, from Bowie and The Who through Roxy and everything. You know, it's always art. It's always art.
Well, that's the thing. It's like you said earlier. It's like, you know, many people went to art college to get a band together.
Yeah.
Said, yeah, my intention was to paint pictures.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
This episode of Rock on Tours is sponsored by AG1, the daily nutrition supplement.
AG1 is a comprehensive and convenient blend of over 70 vitamins, minerals, and other vital ingredients like gut-friendly bacteria, antioxidants, and much more.
Just one scoop of AG1 daily has all the nutrients you need to support your mental performance, energy levels, heart health, and immune system.
To be honest, it's pretty vital stuff for us because when you've got a life on the road and you're short of time or you're too busy to plan and prepare healthy meals, you're getting your podcast together, you're being shouted at and it's just a nightmare, AG1 gives me all the good stuff and helps keep my energy levels where I need, ready for showtime or doing the podcast, and with a nice vanilla taste.
It keeps me focused, feeling good, feeling healthy with its daily dose of vitamin C and zinc. And it's so easy to use. Just one scoop a day gives me over 70 carefully selected ingredients. Simple.
Trusted by Olympians, F1 drivers and the Rock on Tours. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and a free 1 year supply of vitamin D and five free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription.
Go to drinkag1.com/rockontours. That's drinkag1.com/rockontours. Check it out.
And I feel like I want to just jump quickly to talk about London Calling cover at this point.
Oh, no, yeah, because, yes.
Only because of the art school connection between Pete and Paul. Both of them went to art school. Both of them decided to smash the
Well, that's
the
true.
Guitar.
Well, Pete comes from Gustav Metzer, who was the artist who used to have the auto-destructing pieces, who came and came to Art College.
Yeah.
Yours was, you told me this story once years ago, and I don't want to steal your thunder. I don't know if you said, it was basically, I think you were trying to impress your girlfriend.
But the point is, you did say
that it was at the point where that picture's taken, you know, arguably the greatest rock photo
100%
the point I think it's just before that picture is taken that you've realized it's not your spare.
No, you were reading too many things. It was like, listen,
you told this was, this is late at night in a bar somewhere.
Okay. Well, no, basically in London we decided that it wasn't a good idea to play places with seats because then it causes friction between the audience and the bouncers. So when
that used to be a whole thing, didn't it? Like the like, especially in Glasgow places, the bouncers were a tribe of them, like a gang of their own.
So being in New York, everyone was forced to sit down and not get up, and also the sound was rubbish. And really, in death frustration, really, I just reacted in that way.
So this wasn't like a regular occurrence of smashing up a bass?
No, definitely not. It's a one-off.
And she caught it.
Well, you had two, right? You only had two basses. It wasn't built into the, you know.
No.
But if there was going to be one picture from rock and roll, it would be that picture.
It is that picture. Also, because I've seen it, I've been to the exhibition, and it's the most perfectly broken bass ever, you know, and like as an art piece, it's so perfect.
Yeah, these days when I look at it, it seems like it's some sort of religious relic. Or
it's exactly
piece of the cross.
What it is.
Exactly
that.
But yeah, that was just sort of frustration, temper, and I mean, just to give you an example, I know when I was a kid, I living with my mum, I had this sort of clock radio that I really treasured, and it woke you up in the morning with the radio, and it was like amazing. And I was having some argument with my mum, and in desperation, in frustration, I picked up the radio alarm clock and just threw it through the window. And we were living on the fourth floor up, and that was the end of that. So just shows you, I tend to sort of take it out on things that belong to me.
Yeah, I think rather than just a telly, it's something valuable or other precious. People. Yeah, yeah.
I remember, what's his, that guy's name from Sniffing Glue? Perry?
Mark Perry.
Yeah. He was really pissed off when you signed to CBS. He said, punk died the day the Clash signed to CBS. But of course, you had to get your music out there, didn't you?
Well,
there was that kind of attitude, though, wasn't there?
Yeah, well, that's his thoughts, and that's fine. He's entitled to that. But for us, we wanted our record to be in every shop around the world, really. know, it wasn't just to sort of keep it a local thing. It was to for the globe, really.
But also the managed that you managed to maintain this what seemed incredibly combative relationship with your label. I always love that thing on London Calling, where on the you've got the list of credits and it says CBS, and it's like just it's like jail sort of time scratching, where it's like three down, two to go.
Yeah, but you have to understand that because of initially with Bernie's involvement in the beginning, it was all in house. I mean, I remember after we signed, I was taken up to the art department and the guys presented me with what our album cover was going to look like. And it was basically, it was a pair of old boots, not even Dr. Martens, on a northern cobbled street. And that I said, well, that's very nice, but use it for somebody else because we've got ours done already. Because me and Bernie used to work in the beginning on a lot of stuff for the artwork and backdrops and stuff like that.
I think, yeah, because the backdrops and the films were your idea, weren't they? I mean, the first time I saw you was at the Lyceum and it was on that.
Yeah, that was
and, amazing.
Me and Bernie working
that
together.
That was brilliant, all the ones playing at the back.
Well, the good thing about working with Bernie on these things, we decided, because one of the backdrops was sort of like a Stuka flying through the air and on the other side was a grandmother sitting at home watching television with her knitting. So I said, okay, Bernie, yeah. So, we'll put that backdrop of the grandmother on Mick's side and the Stuka on my side. So you see photos of Mick playing guitar with a grandmother sitting watching television in the background.
But it's funny how that's the theme that you've always carried through, because then, like, with...
Well, he was living with his nan.
Then you had that whole U-boat crew look that you...
Yeah.
That's right, because your Mick's nan's flat was... scene of a famous photo shoot, wasn't
That's,
it?
Yeah. So, yeah, it was just... So
as far as backdrops were concerned, you had the Notting Hill Carnival at one point, didn't you, as well?
Yeah, we did.
So I saw you at the Rainbow in 77. And when all the chairs got ripped up.
That's it, yeah.
Terrifying thing ever. I don't know. I don't think I was that scared at the point in time. I just thought it was just unbelievable, all these chairs being thrown around while you were on stage. But I think it was the Notting Hill Carnival.
That's it,
the backdrop, wasn't it?
Yeah, a guy called Rocco McCauley, a Spanish friend of Strummer's, he took that photograph during the riots. And
just to mention this single, and I'm pissed off with this, because 1977 White Riot, I think, was absolutely phenomenal double A-sided record when it came out. And I was convinced that I've got the cover where I think it's Mick and you guys all with your back.
Up against the wall.
Up against
the
wall. Guns
with
and Nice Bridge.
White Riot and 1977 written on the back of your jacket.
Yeah.
I'm looking everywhere for it yesterday. So my brother has stolen it, right? So there were two copies in our house, one of which he bought and one of which I bought, which is the original cover. And I ended up only finding this beauty, which I'm going to get you to sign something later, Paul, definitely. But I just thought it had something about this summed up where the Clash was going to go. White Riot was... It was gonna be more political than the Sex Pistols, more political than the Buzzcocks. Joe was playing anti-racism gigs.
It wasn't thinking about like we're gonna be more political. It's just that the thing is, I'll put it this way. From my background, there's a lot of Jamaican music, West Indian music, is orientated like making social commentary. As was so. People like the Kinks in some ways, mm-hmm. So that was sort of an element of music that and like Joe was really into Woody Guthrie and people that. And so it was like personal politics, not political politics.
But I think the comment with White Riot was, well, there's just been this big riot with the black community in Notting Hill Carnival with 76, and it was, come on, white kids, what are you doing? And the other one, 1977, where you say no Elvis, Beatles or the Rolling Stones. Of course, we still have the Rolling Stones.
But is it true? Because I never heard this, because in Chris's book, or in one of the books, he says that actually at gigs, sometimes Joe used to sing no Elvis, Beatles or Rolling Stones, but John Lennon rules, okay. That's where people used to say. He says that. I'm not saying.
I don't recall you. Joe could have fitted that in.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But he used to move pretty fast, Joe.
but it was a mouthful.
It was a carrying call. It said to all of us young kids, your older cousin's record collection, Yeah, and well, I remember going down to Cheapo Cheapos in Soho and selling every record I had, apart from my punk records. It was great. Yeah. I've spent the rest of my life trying to buy them all back.
Cheapo Cheapos. I was going to say, is that true? Because you seem to have a pretty good collection when we had guests.
No, it's not quite true. There were a few I sneaked in and I left behind. But I did try and get rid of a lot. Yeah.
It was everything had to go, you know.
It was an amazing time.
Well, and now moving on, we're still here and making records.
And let's talk about this. Because the four tracks that we've been allowed to hear.
Yeah, which tracks did you have?
We have Room at the Top.
Oh, yeah,
yeah. Okay. Habia, the Spanish.
A theory, but yeah.
I feel like we need to describe this album a little bit.
We're going to do that. I'm just going to tell Paul what we've got.
Okay.
This is for Paul's benefit more than our audience. Sea Shanty.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And Ghost Town. Not Ghost Town, but is it called Ghost Town?
Maybe somebody lumped that on there and it's...
It's the one about... It's clearly about, you know, the one... It's so lovely about... The town being
Lonely Town.
There's a lovely lightness to that. There's something, and because I know, I hope you wouldn't take this the wrong way, because I know how much we had long chats about Tony Hancock and that whole
person. Yeah.
Because I was suddenly put in mind of the sort of thing that Sid James and Liz Fraser would do.
Like Anthony Newley. I actually love Anthony Newley and so all that background, and like you say, the Bernard Cribbins and all that stuff. That's what we used to listen to on the radio when we were kids growing up. That's which right. they sort of deemed sort of kids' music. But
digging this song.
There's a song that Sid James and Liz Fraser did as a duet, which my dad wrote, called Double Bunk, which is so funny, isn't it?
I think there was probably a film called that as well.
That's right, it was from a film, right.
There's also elements of sort of... I thought it was elements of Serge Gainsbourg in there.
Definitely Serge Gainsbourg.
All sorts. This is where we point out. So this is the album that Paul's just done with Gallen.
Gallen Ayres, yeah.
And it's...
Yeah,
it's,
we did a collaboration.
With Tony Visconti producing, with a stellar cast of really brilliant cast support musicians. And I've got to say, a really beautifully arranged and recorded album. It's like the arrangements are so tight and
so
lovely.
So simple.
Yeah.
Me and Gallen spent ages... Well, she was in Hydra in Greece, and she came over and I got back from being in Spain. And by chance, my friend said, oh, she's staying at my place. And we met up and we talked about doing music together. I mean, it's a bit more of a story to it, but I'm simplifying it. And she had some songs, I had some songs. We just put them together and wrote some new songs and kept challenging each other. I think the first thing we agreed on, that if we're going to work together, it's best that we'll just be as honest as you can.
So you'd gone down to Mallorca, hadn't you, for the pandemic?
Is this Dea?
Well,
is it Dea?
Yeah, it was Dea.
I thought, yeah.
Actually, I was here on the first stint of the pandemic, hence that comment about walking down Park Lane with my eyes closed.
And then
summer turned up and I thought, okay.
JJ Burnell was coming the other way with his eyes closed.
And I went to Spain and had my two little dogs with me. And then, of course, it was like time to go back. And I thought, my son was living at my place and he needed somewhere to stay. And I just stayed out there and just worked, painted, carving and writing songs.
It's the dream, mate. What are you talking
about? Well, but I was in the middle of nowhere.
It is if you choose it, but if you're... Yeah,
it depends where you... It all sounds very idyllic and wonderful, but if your head's not quite there, then it could be like the best place in the world. But
elements of sort of Leonard Cohen on Hydra about how you're describing it.
You've got Leonard Cohen there, you've got Kevin Ayers down there.
Well, Kevin Ayers, I can hear bits of Kevin Ayers in
there. Well, there's a strong element because connections with Gallen, with Dea, and obviously her father, Kevin, and Leonard Cohen, she lives in Greece. Yeah. But what I'm talking about is the songwriting process or just being on your own for a long period of time. You know.
And were you writing these songs with the idea that you were going to put them out one day? Or was it
It was just an outlet.
Because your other, because I know you're painting a lot all the time. But is writing something that's always there for you?
It's just another form of art. It's all art at the end of the day. It's trying to tease lyrics out of oneself. It is a bit like squeezing a pebble. It's not easy.
When were you first allowed to do that? Were you ever allowed to do that in The Clash?
Guns of Brixton was the...
Yeah, I did write stuff, but as I said in the beginning, I spent too much time trying to learn how to play, you know. And it's only like you mentioned, like sort of, I mean, I tackle a few ideas, but it's only sort of the Guns of Brixton that then suddenly I sort of found...
How did that come? Place. Was that just like the one time you thought, I've got something and this is strong enough? And
well, I just had a bass line, and in rehearsals I used to play that, and they used to play along to it, and then eventually I sat down and put some words to it.
It's like Jar Wobble with Public Image. It's one of those just perfect.
Yeah, things. And yeah, Wobble's brilliant.
Yeah, we love Wobble.
So I just have to ask, you know, Norman Watroy plays the bass on Magnificent Seven. How did that feel for you? That was an odd situation.
I thought it was quite a smart move, really. And in some ways, I think, like when you think about the Gorillaz, like Damon Albarn's collaboration with Jamie, what's interesting, they're always having different musicians involved. Mm-hmm. So it's not set sound. It goes all different directions. And anyway, I was sort of in Vancouver being involved in a film, so I couldn't be there. And they were in New York, and Norman was around, and they got Norman in, which is brilliant. And it's, the only thing is, when you're playing live, you have to play that bass line.
Yes.
So, you know.
I've depped for Norman with the Blockheads. I've had to play Hit Me With Your Rhythm Stick with no rehearsal.
Right, okay.
Mate.
Yes. Yeah, Norman's amazing.
So let's just... How did the album come together in the end? So you come back, you just
Well, I came back and I ran into Galen, and she needed somewhere to stay. I said, all right, you can take the middle floor of my place and I'll have the top floor. And just every evening we'd sit down at the kitchen table, and because I don't have a TV, it was like, right, what should we do? Well, there's a guitar, let's just write some songs. And it worked that way. And we got a few people in, Dan Donovan, for example, bring in some gear so we could do some recording, some demos, sent them to Tony Visconti.
Now, this was, how did Tony Visconti come on
board?
Well,
Tony Visconti turned up because I worked with him before with Damon when we did our project, The Good, the Bad,
the Good,
and
the Queen,
on Maryland. At that point, Damon said, Paul, if we don't get a producer, we're going to spend another 10 years with suddenly 200 songs. So we need to put something out and we need a producer. I said, I've got someone in mind. He said, who? I said, Tony Visconti. He said, right, you get him and we'll use him. And then Tony came in. And the great thing about Tony is that he turned around in the middle of it, of recording and with this record. He said, listen, I'm only here to help you make the record that you want to make.
Because it's not like a Tony Visconti record, is it?
No. So he's guiding us, saying, oh, have you thought about this? And we would have laughs. He said, oh, you know this bit, Paul, at the end, I've got an idea. It'd be nice to have some cellos on there. And I'd go, you know what, Tony, that's a really good idea, but you should save it for your album.
Yeah.
So we'd have these bands. So it's like really good.
But no, what I would say, what is Visconti-ish about it is the fact that they are such tight, that the kind of tidiness and sparseness of the arrangement is actually quite reminiscent of what he did with T-Rex. That sort of...
Yeah.
Perfect, you know, just perfect parts, not a lot of them.
Well, that's
obviously, you know, we grew up with him as one of our favourite producers, didn't we?
Yeah, but in terms of the writing, me and Gannon, it was like 50-50. It's like, okay, we'd hear sort of rough things that we did in the demos pre-Tony turning up, and we're cutting and shaping things all the time, just, is that bit really necessary? So it was, yeah.
One of the most beautiful things on the record is the melodica.
Oh, well, that's...
Which is
that's,
Damon Albarn.
Yeah.
And it's just, that just adds a complete unique sound to this.
That's it.
Some mournfulness about that melodica.
Well, it's interesting. Augustus Pablo, isn't it?
But also there's an element of cumbia. Mind you, that's usually an accordion. But the melodica has that sort of sound quality. Or like sea shanties, for example, have that sort of sound with an accordion or a squeeze box. So the melodica doubles up for that as well.
This thing that seems to sit really well is like using scarves, especially, and the spaghetti western type guitar, which is clearly you. There's a lot of it. Some of it sounds like it's a Fender 6, one of those. Sort of,
yeah,
Tony, it's really quite low.
Yeah, Tony Visconti. Because I was trying it on the guitar to play those lines, and he said, "Have you ever heard of one of these?" What, six string bass or something?
Yeah, like.
And
but it's not.
And he got one in, and well, actually, Damon had one in the studio, And I tried it. It's like, wow, this is amazing. It's like, sort of made me think of sort of like Lee Hazelwood. Early Lee Hazelwood songs, exactly. And all that. And so, yeah, I love playing that.
Well, in fact, in Get Back, the Beatles thing, that's what John's playing when he's playing bass, when Paul's playing the piano. Trivia fans.
But the whole album has a kind of... Sorry, I just want to go on about melodica. Was that Dame's idea, or was that your idea? Did you say,
I said, well, ages ago, Damon was sort of saying, nobody ever asked me to come and play on their record with my melodica. So, well, listen, if I get a record,
I saw him in the street.
I'm going to ask you. And then so I phoned him, okay, I need you to come into the studio and you need to do some melodica. So he came in, I said, right, this song's called Sea Shanty. Yeah, I want it sort of nautical. And he went, right, okay. And then back in again in the same session and said, yeah, Damon, could you make it a bit like this? And he said, oh, Paul, I'm not very good at taking directions. So I said, oh, great, thanks for telling me now. But we got some really great stuff.
You've got such a kinship because you've worked together for so long, haven't you?
Yeah.
But the album's got this kind of European feel to it, hasn't it?
It's definitely
pan-European.
Yeah.
You know, obviously with...
Because there's that element of your childhood, isn't there, as well? Was it Siena?
But also like Gallen's... it is more Mallorcan actually. There's all slight different variations. Like English has.
It's not Mallorcan. There's a great word for it. It's one of those really complicated ones, like Mancunian. Yeah, no, but it's a Mayo Domino's.
Something like that. Having another language.
Save that for another podcast.
but you know, it's like the thing is, what came to my mind is like a lot of songs that I really like. Like 60s French, like the Yeah Yeah Girls. Some of them, I don't know what they're saying and what they're singing about, but the vibe on it is so great. And I thought that with Gallen singing in Spanish on the song, as long as it's got the attitude, then you can find out what it's actually about.
And what's all the things she's saying when she's talking at the end of...
Because you've been talking about
villains being down on the Costa del Sol.
She's slagging off the English.
Oh, there you go.
Tourists.
Am I wrong to say that there's a because obviously with the last Good, the Bad and the Queen album as well, which was very sort of, you know, post-Brexit record.
Yeah.
Is there an element of a love letter to Europe about this as well? And is that in your mind?
Yeah, I'm literally half European. It's like, you know, my grandfather on one side was from Liège, Belgium, and the other grandfather was from Whitby in Yorkshire. So...
Let's talk about just working with Damon and how that must be. So you obviously, you know, you ended up in doing those two albums. Then you went on tour with the Gorillaz as well, didn't you?
And you both wore your front door key round your neck. What was that?
That's from a kid.
Wow. He's still got it.
Yeah, it's not the same house though. That's
brilliant. I used to have exactly that. Yeah. And a bit of string.
Yeah, that's it.
But how did that begin, that process of working with him?
What, with Damon?
Yeah. Were you terrified initially?
No, I sort of knew him a little bit, not really. In fact, Chrissie Hynde turned up with him at Joe's wedding, Joe's drummer's wedding, and initiated a group hug between me, Joe, Damon and Chrissie. And so that's the first time I probably met Damon. No, Damon was working on a project.
Do you meet a lot of people like that?
Well, with Chrissie, yes. Damon was working on a project in Africa. It was not going the way he wanted, and he came back and he was thinking about what he needed, and for some reason my name came up, so he invited me over to the studio. We discussed lots of things about London and its history and where we live, and suddenly... The project became The Good, the Bad, and the Queen.
That's the point, which wasn't the band name.
No,
was it?
That was just it's the name of the record.
But also, it's the other one. So, sorry, mate, as a bass player, this is what I'm about. I mean, Tony Allen.
Yes, oh man.
What's that like?
Yeah, Tony Allen, it was like, I remember when we were recording the first album, I said, Damon, you know, on this track, the bass and the drums are not quite working. And Damon said, well, you have to speak to Tony about that, because that's your department. I went, oh, okay. So I went over to Tony, and I could tell everybody was like hiding in the control room, waiting to see what was going to happen. And I went to Tony and said, Tony, you know, on this track, the rhythm, it's not quite working. And I said, so we need to change something. And Tony just said, I'm not changing anything. I went, right, okay. Well, I'll just come up with another bass line. And so it all worked out fine. But then at one point, Tony said, Paul, there's a lot of people that think they're playing bass, and they're not, but you are.
Whoa.
Was it a different way of working from working with The Clash? Was it completely...
Or Havana 3 a.m.
It's a totally different way. Like Damon to have some ideas and we'd sort of rehearse through them. And then new things would develop and Damon would be playing something on the piano. I said, Damon, why don't you try it on that keyboard? Oh, that sounds much better. And it was like, Damon's idea is whoever's got the best idea, let's use it. Mm-hmm. Mind you, it depends who decides which is the best idea. Yeah.
That's
how he is working.
But he's also, he's got serious quality control. I came to see you at the Roundhouse, and I remember, I think it was like the first song where he stopped it.
Oh, yeah.
He stopped it. No. And you started the song again.
Yeah.
But the audience always love that, don't they?
Yeah, of course they love that. But you do not want to be on that stage at that moment, do you? I mean,
he's done that a few times, but to other people.
Right.
And I go, you're not getting me like that. You're not that far away.
But how was it going out with Gorillaz? That must be a whole different thing with the screen and the cartoon stuff going on. Aren't you all sort of working to click tracks?
Well, not really. Well, the drummers are. So we're responding to what the drummers are doing. Right. So there's a bit of free form to what you can do with the bass and guitar. Obviously, that was a difficult one because it's sort of like, I had to sort of learn some like 45 songs and then it got stripped down to 30 and then 25. It was amazing. I think probably the most amazing thing was the cast of characters on stage.
Yeah, and you had like, Mick out.
And Bobby Womack, Lou Reed.
Yeah.
And there was one moment in when we was playing, I think it was Carnegie Hall somewhere, and Lou Reed was singing and I was wearing the sailor outfit, you know, the striped top and the cap, and I was going up to Lee, because I always had that thing where you stand by the singer, sort of protect him, sort of like.
Nice.
And he was singing.
Of course, his old habits die hard, eh?
And he sort of looked round at me and sort of suddenly stopped singing. And I realised I sort of looked a little bit like the back of the Transformer round the
cover. Fantastic.
Because Mick Jones played on that tour as
Yes,
well.
Yeah.
You gave me a lovely description of him about how you said he loved it, and you said it's like the end credits of Dad's Army.
Yeah.
I just don't know what happened to your relationship, obviously, because Mick gets kicked out of The Clash at one point in the 80s.
Yeah, me.
And did you fall out completely after that?
No.
Or during that?
Well, we just had time off. I mean, we should have had a break. We didn't. We worked nonstop for 7 years. It was like a mission rather than a band.
Right. And it was literally, because I remember Joe used to say he wishes it had taken a little bit longer to get up.
Because
you were just from 0 to 100.
We're rash, and it was like, you know what, I can't stand this anymore. Wait for Mick to come down. And he admits, you know, it's like, as Joe said, it's like going on tour with Elizabeth Taylor in a filthy mood. And it's true. but in the end, it was like, for us, it's like, you know what, should we chop our right hands off? Yeah, let's do it. So Mick, we want you out. And then, you know, in some ways it worked out quite well for Mick, because then it woke him up and it got him involved in BAD.
BAD was, it was fantastic. Yeah. I know. And then you went straight to busking.
Yes, that's it, which was just
probably
as brilliant.
Great, yeah.
That was brilliant. That was sort of like, that was like the first Clash tour doing the busking, because it was real.
And
it wasn't padded out with chicken deliveries or pizzas or like limousines or all that sort of stuff. It
people refusing to move until the score turns up.
I just want to show you a few covers. I dug these singles out on the way here. If you have any memories of what went on here, look at that. That was a great record, wasn't it? Clash City Rockers.
This is
Antiques Roadshow. Road.
This is Antiques Roadshow.
Yeah.
But I was also going to mention some of the producers.
I was hoping we'd have one.
I've got some here. This is like sort of.
Well, do you know, I want to throw in, before we end, I want to throw in a personal thing, right? Which I've got, this is a measure of the man that this is, which is that it was about 18 years ago now when I decided I was going to try and do a stand-up show. And I did this members' dinner at the Groucho Club, right, where I
people came to that dinner. Then I told a few stories and it was horrible and I hated it, but it went really well and I ended up getting on Radio 2 and then Edinburgh and everything. But I came downstairs and I was in a right shape. I was having a few stiff drinks to calm down. And this one rocks up, right? Clearly hadn't been, he'd been at something more culturally significant and glamorous than my thing. And we were having a lovely chat, as we want to do. And for some reason it came up, I said, oh, guess what? As a good luck charm, I was wearing John Entwistle's watch. So I showed, and I had John Entwistle's old watch. And you went, oh, well, if you've got one bass player's watch, you should have another. And you took off this watch and gave it to me.
Oh, there you go.
Which I still have to this day.
Wow, that's amazing.
There you go.
Are you going to go out on tour?
Yeah, hopefully. Let's see how it goes. I mean, you know, I mean, yeah, it'd be nice to do some shows, but I don't really...
Because you've got a band, haven't you, really? Got Simon.
I mean, what I really liked on the last tour that I did with Damon for the Good Band and the Queen is that we did a load of shows up like Hartlepool, Newcastle, right around there on the East Coast. It's like amazing.
That's, yeah, yeah.
Like working men's clubs.
Brilliant.
That's really great.
So that might be.
Yeah, I'm definitely up for going up there again.
Do you think they've softened in their Brexit ideas now?
Well, you know, that was probably quite interesting for them and us. Is like it was like a musical debate in some ways. Yeah. Us being and just talking about it, you know. And so we'll probably do some shows there. We might do one in London and maybe a bistro in Paris or something.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for coming on, Paul.
Yeah, yeah, well, thank you very much. Really,
and thanks for bringing us together in real life.
Yes, I know. Hey.
Because, this is just feels so unique to be.
Well, I thought it'd be a good idea, just in case somebody was going to say something a bit wrong, then at least I can reach one of you from here.
Old habits die hard.
Yeah, JJ, you listening?
He's been massaging his throat all the way through, I like to point out.
Thank you, mate. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much,
I won't say what
mate.
You've been doing.
That was
my car's here.
He looked pretty cool, didn't he? In his pinstripe suit.
That's his shtick. That has been
for a long time.
And this is a thing I like, right, about all the people that I know from punk bands, is that unlike their predecessors, they're always beautifully turned out.
I want to talk to you about that picture again, because the smashing of the bass guitar, and Pete smashing his guitar, and of course
he definitely told me it was, he thought it was his spare.
He did.
He definitely told me that. Yes. But like I said, this was late.
No, he
at
said,
night.
He actually didn't. He said, you're my spare. No, but listen, I just want to talk to you about that, because why do you think we're so fascinated with, so energized by rock stars smashing their instruments? I mean, when I was a kid, your instrument was so important to you.
No, exactly. And that was because you forget that when Pete used to do it, there used to be all these letters from people absolutely outraged. And it was. I mean, it's, and Rickenbackers, man, they were a fortune for, the likes of you and I. Just getting a guitar was so hard. And the idea, getting a T-shirt.
But we still, we love what he's doing. And it gives him power, doesn't it? It's saying like, I can get another one tomorrow because I'm up on this stage and you're down there.
Yeah, I don't think it's even that. I think it's just to do with the moment. There's just something so sort of, it's like a sacred frozen moment.
Also, when Pete started doing it, guitars weren't precious then, really. Not as precious as they are now. Everyone wants to know where that SG is that he smashed on stage at Woodstock. Do you know where it is?
No, I don't. But I did actually have one of his SGs for a while. One of the ones he used in England. But he actually didn't smash them very often. But the head of it was really mashed up from where he'd been stuffing into
computers. Yeah, so there's really two. There is the picture of Pete with the guitar behind his back.
Yeah.
And that is probably second iconic.
But that's what
photograph.
It is. Yes, it is. But it's not so much
this
about...
This guitar is about to die,
like,
isn't it? What's that?
Oh, this guitar's got seconds to live.
Seconds to live.
And it's... I think it's more... It's like... It's just the drama of the pose, isn't it? It's like great football photos or something, isn't
totemic.
It?
Totemic.
Totemic. That's what it
that's
is.
That's what it is. It becomes a weapon.
Yeah, and that's how we saw the guitar. It's an axe. I mean, it's a weapon.
Yeah, and I'm not going to smash mine. I think I did once on the TV show, but it was rented and it was cheap. And we got in trouble with the producers afterwards.
Well, I've got a long story about the one I tried to smash at Earl's Court. Well,
can you make it short?
Was made of, I'm not going to tell it here. It's in my book.
Oh, my God, is this an advert for the book?
It's probably on YouTube. It's probably on YouTube. We'll Guy Pratt smashing bass story.
We'll get there next time or some stage. Say thank you to the people at Warners who put all this together for us today.
We actually have this very elaborate crew today, which is we're looking at now. Fabulous, gorgeous looking people.
And of course, Ben Jones from Gimme Sugar Productions. And also, I'm just reminding people to follow us on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter. We are there. We put up stuff all the time during the week.
We always put up little bits and pieces, and we do love to read your comments when they're nice.
100%. Thank you, and we'll see you next week.
It's good night from me.
It's good night from them.
Thanks awfully.
Rockanteurs is produced by Gimme Sugar Productions for Warner Music Group UK.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.